going to continue discussing the ordinance of covenanting as an ordinance, public social covenanting as an ordinance to be continued under the New Testament. We especially want to talk about the idea this time of continued obligation, the idea of the descending obligation of covenants and how that fits with the rest of what we've talked about with respect to covenanting. We've talked about covenanting in its public and social aspect, that it's not binding to some new duty, but it is additionally binding to a duty which is already a duty that is calling us to obedience. So we want to discuss now this idea of descending obligation, and that presupposes this idea of moral personage, that the church and the nation are in some sense possessed of a corporate identity, an identity which isn't tied up with or in any individual members, but that continues despite the change in members, the constituent members. Nonetheless, if there is a body, a corporate body, church or state, and this would continue to have an identity, a transmissible identity. A nation is a body that is held together by kinship, by custom, common custom, and by common culture. The whole idea of a nation is bound up with that. And in very much the same way, the church shares a spiritual kinship, a spiritual culture, and even a spiritual spiritual perpetuity. There's a spiritual person. So that when we've talked about the national establishments, we talked about the church as representing the moral person, the spiritual aspect of the moral person, if you will, and the state or the nation as representing that social and corporeal aspect of that moral person. The reason this idea of descending obligation is so important is this: our fourth term of communion continues that public social covenanting is an ordinance of God, obligatory on churches and nations under the New Testament, that the National Covenant and the Solemn League are an exemplification of this divine institution, and that these deeds are of continued obligation upon the moral person. So, before we look at the National Covenant or the Solemn League, we really need to examine this idea of continuous or descending obligation upon the moral person. What is it we're asserting, and why are we asserting that? So the first question then that we want to talk about in this connection is this: what is the principle upon which the continuous or descending obligation of covenants is founded? The answer is that this principle is founded in the right which parents have to represent their posterity in certain social transactions. Now look at Exodus 13:19.
Exodus 13, verse 19. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had straitly sworn the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and ye shall carry up my bones away hence with you.
Now, last time we ended with this verse, talking about it briefly, the fact that Joseph could commend his bones to posterity and impose upon them an obligation. He bound them to a certain course of action with respect to his the interment of his body. He made them take an oath. He made them, in fact, promise, swear, that they would, when they went up, take him with them, or take his remains with them. And that is really what we're talking about here. It's founded in that principle that parents do have a right to represent their posterity. And again, in talking about other things, like infant baptism, we've discussed this idea. Parents, by their actions, affect their children, their posterity. You know, if through the misdeeds of a previous generation, an entire nation becomes decimated by war, or brought to some kind of economic turmoil like we see going on now in this country, those actions have imposed obligations and restrictions on posterity. Covenanting is taking that principle from a little bit more of a positive point of view. There are restrictions, there are in fact obligations, but there's also in covenanting an idea that subsequent generations are going to own that they're going to voluntarily assume that obligation. But just like in infant baptism, there's an assumption going on that at some point the person baptized is going to enter into that relation voluntarily, that they're going to acquiesce to the obligations and so on. So, it's supposed, this right, in the continued identity of society throughout successive generations. And we see this if we look at Deuteronomy 5, verses 2 to 4.
Deuteronomy 5, verses 2 to 4. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us, who are alive this day. The Lord talked with you face to face in the mount out of the midst of the fire.
Moses is talking to people, most of whom were not there. Or if they were, they were children. They were not actively engaged in that process that he's referring to as binding them. And yet he continues to talk about the Lord spoke to us, the Lord did this with us. Why is he using that language? It's the language of identity. It's the kind of language people use when they speak of themselves as being American or French or German or Korean or Egyptian. You know, it's a very natural thing for people to reach and place themselves in this corporate identity, to find themselves in that. That identity that absorbs the individual also transcends the individual, so that that identity continues when individuals either leave the nation or either voluntarily through immigration, for example, or involuntarily through war, being dispossessed, or even by reason of death. Yet there's still this continued identity that nations have. It's a cultural identity. It's an identity that is tied up with traditional usages, customs. And that, in cases of nations, is usually bounded by a sense of kinship. All of that provides an identity. When families have that identity that transcends. When family members die, the family doesn't cease to exist. The family goes on. Families are bigger than individuals, and yet they're smaller than nations. But we see the same kind of idea. There's an identity. And that's an important thing that people tend to try to hold on to. Right? So there's a supposition then of this continued identity. The Bible recognizes its reality. When Moses keeps saying us, 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 he's saying this is a real thing. It's not just your imagination. There is something bigger than you. There's something outside of you. There's something of which you are merely a part. And that for only a time. So this idea of continuous or descending obligation, it does have reference to this identity, this continued identity. When the moral person that is possessed of this identity assumes an obligation, that obligation then is being enjoined on posterity. And posterity doesn't really have a right to disavow that. They have, in fact, an obligation to own it. Now, in covenanting, it's even a little bit more pronounced than that, as we'll see. All right, it naturally enough follows from the common interest which children have, along with their parents, in those objects for which federal deeds are framed. Look at Romans 5:12.
Romans 5:12. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned.
The fact is that Reformed theology is federal theology. At its root, we make certain assumptions that we believe are biblical assumptions about the nature of the fall and the nature of redemption. And that is that all men fell in Adam, and that all of the elect will be redeemed in Christ. Those are federal concepts. That there could be a head, a federal head, whose actions are going to affect everyone who is descended from that federal head. That idea of descending obligation is implied in that. In Adam, there's a covenant of works. He broke it. We're never going to keep it aright, but that does not release those descending from Adam by ordinary generation from an obligation, a duty, to keep that covenant of works. We know they're not going to, but that obligation remains, and that's why those who are, in fact, those who remain in their sins, who remain at war with God, those people are going to be judged with respect to a broken covenant of works. Yes, Adam broke it. But they, as Paul goes on to point out in Romans 5, through the similitude of their sin, that is, they sin in similar ways, they're owning that. They're saying, yeah, okay, Adam did it, but I own that obligation. I voluntarily assume all of that. That federal concept then, the federal deeds, covenants, those are covenants. There's a covenant made with Adam, there's a covenant made with Christ. Those covenants are federal deeds. And there's a common interest then that children have with respect to those covenants in common with their parents. In this case, then, representation springs not from choice, as when men appoint their civil and ecclesiastical functionaries. But from the appointment of God, from a divinely authorized constitution, a constitution the existence of which is distinctly recognized in the case of Levi. Look at Hebrews 7, 9 and 10.
Hebrews 7, verses 9 and 10. And as many as I so say, Levi also, who paid tithes in Abraham, for he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him.
He's yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. Paid tithes. He was there. There's an idea here of a federal representation, but it's not arbitrary. It's not something that is springing simply from the choice of men. There's something in the very constitution of a society. You know, families are brought together by covenant, but you know, children don't have a choice with respect to parents. People don't have a choice as to where they're going to be born. They may have a choice where their children are going to be born, but they don't have a choice where they're going to be born, where they were born. You didn't choose that. That choice was made. It was made apart from any consideration that you might have wanted to contribute had you had the capacity to do so. So there is in this idea a divinely authorized constitution. There is, in fact, an organic union in the case of families and nations, and even to some extent in the case of the church, because the church is composed not only of those who profess the true religion, but also their children. Continuous or descending obligation of covenants is founded on and is presupposed then by this idea of federal representation, that there can be, in fact, covenants made, that there can, in fact, be responsibilities and obligations incurred by a previous generation that will, in some respect, bind a subsequent generation. Right? The second question then is, what is the reason of this continuous obligation of covenants? The reason may be ascertained, first of all, from the fact that God will have it so. Look at Psalm 76:11.
Psalm 76:11, thou and pay unto the Lord your God, let all that thee round about him bring presents unto him that ought to fear.
And thou and pay unto the Lord. There is an obligation, a continuous obligation. God would have covenants to be obliging, and they're going to be obliging upon the person, the moral person, that entered into those covenants. But the second thing is that there is to be considered the permanency of the subject coming under the obligation. The church and the nation are corporations existing and perpetuated in succession of generations. Look at Ecclesiastes 1:4.
Ecclesiastes 1:4. One generation passeth away, and another generation cometh, but the earth abideth forever.
The one generation passeth away, another cometh, but the earth abideth forever. There is a presumption in the observation of the preacher that there's a continuity. The generations come and go, but the earth, that is, the system, the world system, remains in place. It's not going anywhere. And that includes the church and nation as corporations. Right, the succeeding coming into the obligations of the preceding, as a matter of fact. So that when one generation passes away, the succeeding generation comes into the obligations of that previous generation. Look at Psalm 103, 17 and 18.
Psalm 103, 17 and 18. But the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting upon them that fear Him, and His righteousness to children's children, such as keep His covenant, and those that remember His commandments to do them.
And God says His mercy is to from generation to generation to those who keep His covenant. Now, there is then a succession in generations and an obligation in covenant on the part of the church or the part of the nation. On the other hand, the other party in these covenants that we're going to talk about is God. And God, as party to such deeds, always exists. Look at Psalm 102:12.
Psalm 102:12. But thou, O Lord, shalt endure forever, and thy remembrance unto all generations.
God always exists. He's not passing out. When we talk about covenants, covenants exist as long as the parties entering into the covenant continue to exist. Which is why in the covenant of marriage, when one party dies, the other party is loosed from that covenant. The covenant ceases at that point because one of the parties has dissolved. Now, the church is not going to dissolve. And very seldom, in fact, do nations disappear. On the other hand, we have absolute certainty that God isn't going away. So when these covenants are entered into in a national capacity or a church capacity, there's reason to suspect that the obligation is a little bit more permanent than most people today tend to think. Now, we need to ask questions. If one or both parties have vanished, ceased to be, then the covenant is clearly going to be negated. It'll be at an end. It will have reached its end with the end of the existence of the persons involved. But in covenants that exist, that wherein one party is God, we can be assured He's not going anywhere. And when the other is a national church or a nation, there's a lot of reason to be skeptical as to whether or not that nation or that church, as a corporate moral person, can cease to exist. Very seldom does this happen. All right, the third thing is that the sameness of the relation to the moral governor of the universe. What I mean by that is this: corporation and all of its members are related to God as moral subjects to a rightful sovereign. Look at Isaiah 33:22.
Isaiah 33:22. For the Lord is our judge, the Lord is our lawgiver, the Lord is our king, He will save us.
When we talk about the church, when we talk about nations, we're talking about moral persons which stand directly in a relation to God. They bear the same relation to the moral governor of the universe. They're all moral subjects. You know, it's not simply a matter of individuals being moral subjects. but nations and churches are moral subjects. The duties being moral to which the covenant binds, and by virtue of the moral relations of the corporate society to the divine obedience to God according to his law, according to the divine sovereign in successive generations, those moral relations are bound. They're bound by the deed. Look at Psalm 145:4.
Psalm 145:4. One generation shall praise thy works to another, and shall declare thy mighty acts.
It's the duty of one generation to declare the acts of God to another. They bear the same moral relations, one generation to another. There isn't a different relation from generation to generation, nor is there a different relation between church and state and individuals. They're all subject to the same moral governor. They're bound by the same moral relations. The corporate society, then, is bound to show forth that obligation in making declarations from generation to generation. That is, the previous generation has an obligation to tell the succeeding generation, to impress upon them what they've done and why they've done it. The succeeding generation, in its turn, has an obligation to heed, to hear, and to obey. Voluntarily, they ought to be assuming that obligation when a church or a nation have entered into covenant. Right, the fourth consideration here, the reason for continuous obligation, is that obligation to God, obedience to God, according to his law, is a debt which no one generation can fully pay. In fact, it remains each successive generation the same. Hence, the covenant obligation must be continuous. Look at Deuteronomy 5:9-10 and Malachi 2:10.
Deuteronomy 5:9-10. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquities of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments.
Malachi 2:10. Have we not all one Father? Hath not one God created us? Why do we deal treacherously, every man against his brother, by profaning the covenant of our fathers?
If we consider again this debt, the debt is based in a duty, a moral duty. The covenants bind to moral duties. Moral duties don't change from generation to generation. The applications of those moral duties may shift a bit, but the obligations, the moral obligations, do not change, because each generation bears that same relation to the moral governor of the universe. And so, the debt that is implied in these covenants is not one that one generation can fulfill for another. When the church binds herself to a course of obedience to the law of God, it's not as if a previous generation, by its obedience, will render enough obedience that the following generation can be disobedient and God's going to be okay with that. Now, the Roman Church has a theory with regard to this. It's called, they call them works of supererogation. The idea that the saints can lay up a treasury of good works that will be efficacious for generations to come. But that's not what the Bible is saying here. A previous generation is not going to make up for the disobedience of a subsequent generation, nor will a subsequent generation make up for the disobedience of a previous generation. Each generation, each age, the church bears the same moral responsibility. The duties aren't shifting. They're not changing. So that if they're moral duties, if they are in fact these kinds of things that pertain to moral duties that have been covenanted originally, they're never really going away. When the church covenanted to be obedient to God, it covenanted to do what it was already its duty to do. It was simply voluntarily assuming that obligation. Subsequent generations share that obligation. They ought to be concerned to see that they are putting forth themselves in a way of obedience, voluntarily assuming these obligations. One generation is not going to bear one kind of moral stance with respect to the creator of the universe, the governor of the universe, and then the next generation some other. But we should always be suspicious when we see that kind of shifting ground. We see it in churches, we see it in nations, but it should always look suspicious. One generation, then, obedience to God can't be fulfilled from, you know, by one generation for another, whether we're looking backward or looking forward. All right, fifth, covenanting is a means of holiness. Each successive generation needs to be sanctified, and consequently, each successively needs this instrumentality. Hence, covenant obligation is transmitted with a stream of succeeding generations. Look at Deuteronomy 8, 18 to 20.
Deuteronomy 8, verses 18 to 20. But thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is he that giveth thee power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he sware unto thy fathers, as it is this day. And it shall be, if thou do at all forget the Lord thy God, and walk after other gods, and serve them, and worship them, I testify against you this day that ye shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroyeth before your face, so shall ye perish, because ye would not be obedient unto the voice of the Lord your God.
So what is it Moses is pointing out? He's pointing out that this covenant obligation is transmitted from generation to generation. Because the moral duty is transmitted. Because the reason behind the covenant is transmitted. The obligation descends. Now, the obligation of a succeeding generation to obedience is only heightened when a previous generation has been obedient. It heightens it. But that does not mean that a succeeding generation after a deforming generation ought to be relaxing its stance and saying, oh, well, at least we're not that bad. The moral duty held forth by the law of God is absolute. There's a perfection to it. That obligation is an obligation which falls down with it. As the obligation of that moral duty moves from generation to generation, the obligation of covenanting moves from generation to generation. The obligation to own a covenant which has already been entered into on your behalf by the corporate person. That obligation is transmitted from generation to generation. Covenanting, remember, is a means by which men voluntarily take hold of the obligations of the covenant of grace. They take hold of the responsibilities and the obligations in a voluntary way. That's the way to true holiness. When we love the law of God, when we desire to do what's right, not simply because it's right, but because it is conducive to the glory of God. We've gone beyond that struggle where we're thinking that if we do enough right and avoid enough wrong, it's going to keep us out of hell. Now, we're talking about a different kind of thinking. Holiness is going to be best advanced when people voluntarily assume covenant obligation. So successive generations then need that instrumentality of covenanting. The covenant obligation is transmitted. All right, the third question is not the principle of the transmissible nature of the obligation of public social covenants founded in reason and equity? And the answer is yes. The fact is this, that when the matter of a covenant is lawful and the parties continue to exist, the covenant itself retains its obligation until the object it contemplates has been gained. Look at Romans 7:2.
Romans 7, verse 2. For the woman which hath an husband is bound by the law to her husband so long as he liveth. But if the husband be dead, she is loosed from the law of her husband.
Okay, there's a loosing. Why? Because the end of that covenant has been reached. Until death do us part. The end of the covenant was reached. The obligation then comes to an end. But when we're talking about moral obligations, now those things, moral obligations, and actions rooted in moral obligation, well, those things are not going to come to an end. We can't say, oh, well, you know, I've kept this commandment or that commandment all my life long until now. Now, I guess it's okay to break out of that. When there's a covenant between God and the church or God and the nation, that covenant then continues to be obligatory long after the original framers of it may be gathered to their fathers. Look at Exodus 19:5 and 6.
Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. Now therefore, if you will obey my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then you shall be a particular treasure unto me above all people, from all the earth, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom, a priest, and an holy nation. These are the words which thou shalt speak unto the children of Israel.
The covenants between God and the church, God and the nation, those covenants are going to remain obligatory after the original framers have returned to the dust. They're binding you to moral duties, moral deeds. They're binding you to a debt that already exists simply by nature. And they're asking for a bond of a voluntary bond to go with that. Well, those things are going to remain anyway. But the obligation of covenants does not come to an end when the people, the representatives of those people of a particular generation who have entered into it, when they pass on, that doesn't alleviate, that doesn't wipe away that debt. The nations have constitutions for a reason. They tend to have a body of law for a reason. They tend to give care to how they interpret law for a reason. They understand that previous acts of previous generations inform and bind. And that brings a certain amount of stability to a society. Now, the object contemplated may be a degree of reformation hitherto unattained. The parties, too, must be held as continuing to exist. God, the one party, being the eternal God, the church or the nation, the other party, continuing in virtue of that identity which a corporate body possesses. This identity is not affected by the constant changes a society may undergo as regards individual members. We're not looking at that. We understand individual members come and go. Individual members may ebb and flow. But covenant identity of the moral person, that identity that is there in that covenant, that remains. When a church is a church, a nation is a nation, enters into covenant, there's an identity that they've assumed in that act. And that identity remains. It becomes part of who that church or that nation is. All right, the fourth question. Is not this principle of the continuous transmissible obligation of covenants highly advantageous in its tendency? And the answer is yes. Not to say that there are not downsides to it, not to say that there aren't penalties, curses for breaking it. We're entering into a covenant where we're taking an oath. We're calling heaven and earth to witness against us if we fail to uphold our end of that bargain that we've entered into voluntarily. But covenanting, and in fact, the continuous obligation of these covenants being transmitted, well, that is a principle which, in fact, ought to make people take note and give ear to the advantages, benefits. There's a benefit to being born into a society, whether it's a family, a nation, or a church. If you were simply born and left somewhere, it would be akin to the old Roman practice of exposing infants. You would die. There's a benefit to being born into a family. When you can't take care of yourself, there are other people who immediately begin to take care of you, take up your cause, advance you in the world. The same goes for the nation and for the church. There are things which have gone before that redound to your benefit if you make use of them properly. The advantageousness of this appears, first of all, in this. It strengthens that sense of gratitude to God by which men are stimulated to obedience, by leading the children to reflect on His goodness and having regard to their welfare and the covenant made with their fathers, and comprehending them in the same federal transaction. In fact, this is what Peter reminds the Jews about in
Acts 3:25.
Yeah, Peter reminds the Jews that there is in fact an advantage here. God's going to bless the world through you. Why should you be obedient? Why should you seek to undergo that assumption of covenant obligation. There's a benefit, not only an immediate benefit to you, but that benefit accrues to your family and those descending from you. It accrues to those who are nearest and dearest to you. When you break covenant, that affects them as well. There's this thread of this federal principle going on. It goes well with a nation when the leaders of the nation are believers. It goes well with the church when the leaders of the church are faithful. It goes well with the family when the leaders of the family are believers. When men understand that they have been comprehended in this same federal transaction, they had no choice, that it came before them. The grace of God was actually there before them. It ought to strengthen a sense of gratitude. They should be interested in being obedient. But second, it inspires confidence in the promised mercies of God, and it affords ground to hope that he who has been gracious in times that are past to the fathers will be gracious still to their children. This is what Moses, this is the way Moses encouraged the people of Israel. Look at
Deuteronomy 4:31. Deuteronomy 4:31. For the Lord thy God is a merciful God. He will not forsake thee, neither destroy thee, nor forget the covenant of thy fathers which he sware unto them.
Moses says, look, God is not going to forget the covenant. You can see when they were faithful to the covenant, God blessed them. He upheld them. He cared for them. Conversely, when they were not, he punished and chastised them. You can see both sides of it. If you're worried as to whether or not God will keep his promise, look at what he did in times past to those who kept covenant with him. Look how he treated them. The third, it furnishes a powerful argument in pleading with God at the throne of grace, as we find exemplified and confirmed in Jeremiah's expostulation with God concerning the state of his nation. Look at Jeremiah 14:21.
Jeremiah 14:21. Do not abhor us for thy name's sake. Do not disgrace the throne of thy glory. Remember, break not thy covenant with us.
When Jeremiah is praying, when he's pleading for the people of Israel, what does he do? He reminds God of his covenant, of which God himself is one of the parties. And so he takes hold of that covenant and pleads with God concerning the state of Israel. Right, fourth, it throws a shield over a people by which the wrath of God is averted. If you look at Leviticus 26:44-45.
Leviticus 26:44-45. And yet for all that, when they be in the land of their enemies, I will not cast them away, neither will I abhor them, to destroy them utterly, and to break my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will for their sakes remember the covenant of their ancestors, whom I brought forth out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the heathen, that I might be their God. I am the Lord.
Transmission of obligation of covenants, again, is a transmission of privilege, of promise, of hope. There's a certain knowledge that God has dealt with the people in this way. There's a certain knowledge that God has, in fact, retained a people unto himself preserved them unto himself, kept them from utter destruction. God's covenant with his people is in fact shown to be in this covenanting on the part of the people of God, shown to be a dynamic force in the life of the church. They see on the heels of this covenant obligation the rewards and the punishments. They see God active in the lives of the people who make up the church or the nation in covenant with him. Now, they're not looking at things in a deistical fashion where all of the events of providence make no sense. They see things in terms of blessings to covenant keepers, curses to covenant breakers. They understand that there is, in fact, a blessing in this, that God is throwing a shield over the people in this covenant. His wrath is being averted. Why? Well, because these are people who voluntarily taken care to assume the obligation of the covenant. They're not trying to break covenant. They're not striving to get out of the obligation. They're striving to enter into the spirit of the obligation, to find their place in the obedience that God requires. Descending obligations of covenants makes this point clear to those who succeed. The previous generations have sort of spelled out. They've made a, you know, they've created a path. They've set the parameters and said, "This is what we mean. We're going to be obedient unto God. We need to do this and we need to do that. We need to behave in this way and not in that way." That kind of knowledge is a shield. Fifth, it's not less fitted to keep up a remembrance of the wonderful things done by God on behalf of a people by forming a record of them and furnishing a medium for their transmission from generation to generation. 1 Chronicles 16:12-16
Remember his marvelous works that he hath done, his wonders, and the judgments of his mouth. O ye seed of Israel, his servant, ye children of Jacob, his chosen ones, he is the Lord our God, his judgments are in all the earth. Be mindful always of his covenant, the word which he commanded to 1,000 generations, even of the covenant which he made with Abraham, and of his oath unto Isaac.
Covenanting occurs in history. Public social covenants are entered into in historical context. They form then a record of the providences of God on behalf of a people. And they transmit that record from generation to generation. They give a sense of what God has done and what God will do through a people who are striving to keep covenant with him, to a people and through a people who are striving to render an acceptable obedience to him. The obligation of these covenants from generation to generation is a perfect way for God to keep alive from generation to generation a remembrancing of his wonderful works on behalf of his people. And when you talk about covenants and you talk about what went into them, you have to remember a bit what God did and why he did it, what the people of God who were entering into covenant, what they did and why they did it. That's a record. That's one generation telling another generation, spelling it out. But sixth, above all, it is eminently fitted by beginning a delightful mutual interest between fathers and children to promote and display the unity of the church. The fathers being required to transact for the children, and the children by being required to recognize the needs of the fathers, it must be inspired with a double and most salutary interest in each other. All selfish and exclusive feeling is in this way rebuked. Present generation are taught to look back to the past, as the past are supposed to have looked forward to the future. The distant periods are united, and the interests of different generations are concentrated. Look at John 17:11 and Deuteronomy 5:2 and 3.
John 17, verse 11. And now I am no more in the world, but these are in the world, and I come to thee. Holy Father, keep through thine own name those whom thou hast given me, that they may be one as we are.
Deuteronomy 5, verses 2 and 3. The Lord our God made a covenant with us in Horeb. The Lord made not this covenant with our fathers, but with us, even us, who are all of us here alive this day.
In the act of covenanting, there's a presumption that the people who are entering into the covenant, the fathers, are looking forward. They're thinking about what needs to be done on behalf of posterity. In keeping the same covenant, in upholding the obligations that have descended to them, the succeeding generation is, in fact, honoring the preceding generation. There is, in fact, then a certain mutual interest. When the church enters into covenants, it does so with an interest, with a view to the future. The act of covenanting is, in itself, very forward-looking. It's future-oriented. For those who own the obligations of those covenants, there's an act that is, in fact, very deferential to the judgments, the concerns, the reforms, all of the different things that the fathers are putting forth. There is a proper respect, then, and a proper bond, which creates a unity from one generation to another. Now, covenanting creates an atmosphere entirely contrary to this modern idea of generational gaps, that there need be this radical disconnect between previous and subsequent generations. There is a bit of reciprocity going on, where the generation, the covenants, is being required to contemplate the future, to think about where things are headed. Conversely, that descending obligation is placing demands, very clear and strenuous demands, on subsequent generations to render that obedience which is fitting. All that then promotes a view of a unified church where one generation is serving another in turn, and where together they're serving the truth. They're striving together for the same truth. They're not at different points. They're not looking past one another. They're not ignoring one another. But they're, in fact, demonstrating that kind of spiritual unity. Remember, again, we're talking about substantially a number of moral duties. They're unchanging and unchangeable. We're talking about a course of action, perhaps, on the part of those who enter into the covenants. But those things are all of them, designed to bring about and promote a church which is rooted in the past, and yet a church which is looking forward to the future. A church which is together, past, present, and future, concerned with an obedience, a performance of that moral duty that is being held forth in the covenants and in their obligations. Now, the fifth question we want to deal with briefly is covenanting is stated an ordinary or occasional and extraordinary duty. And the answer is it's occasional and extraordinary. In other words, covenanting is not something that is going to be done all the time, at all times, in all places. Something which is called forth providentially from time to time. Therefore, it's occasional. It's something which is not ordinary in the sense that there's not a regular performance of it. It doesn't have a regular part to play in the life of the church. It's kind of like days of fasting and days of thanksgiving. They're extraordinary. They're occasional. They're not going to be routine. They're not regularly occurring things. It's not like we're going to say every year at this time of year we're going to get together and covenant. The usual course is that there's some providential event unfolding that has moved the church to enter into these covenants. There's been some sort of providential push, even in the renewing of the covenants. This is some of the things that we will talk about as we look at the National Covenant, the Psalm Leading Covenant, and so on. But just remember, it's not ordinary. It's not stated. It's occasional. It's extraordinary. And that's precisely why we're not saying it has to be done every week or every month or even every year. There are specific providences which are pervasive enough to press upon the church a desire to do this, to say, okay, we need to obey. All right, the last question we want to talk about is what are some of the times and seasons in which the church or a nation is called on to engage in this extraordinary yet important duty? Well, such times and seasons are many and various. The first time or season that presents itself as a good time for this activity is during times of public humiliation for apostasy from God. Look at Jeremiah 50, verses 4 and 5.
Jeremiah 50, verses 4 and 5. In those days and in that time, saith the Lord, the children of Israel shall come, they and the children of Judah together, going and weeping. They shall go and seek the Lord their God. They shall ask the way to Zion with their faces thitherward, saying, come and let us join ourselves to the Lord in a perpetual covenant that shall not be forgotten.
This idea that that we should be some people have thought that we're saying this should be going on all the time. Well, if we were living in a time when it was not only a matter of apostasy, but if there was a public humiliation for that apostasy from God, we would be turning back to God in droves, and that would be a time. That would be an occasion. That would be a fitting mark that would be pushing us to enter into covenant with God. And why? Well, because we would be at a time where, in great likelihood, the apostasy is about to turn. There may, in fact, be a renewed zeal of obedience. A second time when covenanting, public social covenanting, is a good choice, a good thing to engage in, is during times of affliction. Look at Nehemiah 9:1 and 38, and 2 Chronicles 34, 29 to 32.
Nehemiah 9, verses 1 and 38, verse 1. Now on the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting and with sackcloth and earth upon them. In verse 38, and because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our princes, Levites, and priests seal unto it.
2 Chronicles 34, verses 29 through 32. Then the king sent and gathered together all the elders of Judah and Jerusalem. And the king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and the priests, and the Levites, and all the people, great and small. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant that was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood in his place and made a covenant before the Lord to walk after the Lord, and to keep his commandments and his testimonies and his statutes with all his heart and with all his soul, to perform the words of the covenant which were written in this book. And he caused all that were present in Jerusalem and Benjamin to stand to it. And the inhabitants of Jerusalem did according to the covenant of God, the God of their fathers.
So in times of affliction, when God is pouring out his afflicting rod on a society or church, that's another good time. You see humiliation for apostasy, times of affliction. Those are both good times for the church or the nation to consider covenanting. We want God to deliver us. A third time or season would be times of public reformation. Look at 2 Kings 23:1-3.
2 Kings 23:1-3. And the king sent, and they gathered unto him all the elders of Judah and of Jerusalem. The king went up into the house of the Lord, and all the men of Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem with him, and the priests and the prophets, and all the people, both small and great. And he read in their ears all the words of the book of the covenant which was found in the house of the Lord. And the king stood by a pillar and made a covenant before the Lord, to walk after the Lord and to keep his commandments, his testimonies, and his statutes with all their heart and all their soul, to perform the words of this covenant that were written in this book. And all the people stood to the covenant.
If it's a time of public reformation, when we have public leaders who are moving in that direction, covenanting is a good idea. You see an increased interest in religion. Not simply the negative, that there's been a humiliation, sackcloth and ashes and so on, because of apostasy. Not simply because we're getting the divine whipping that we so deserve, but during times of public reformation, when people are being moved by the Spirit of God in a forward-thinking direction with respect to the church, when the concern is not necessarily to just simply to escape the rod, But the concern is more positive than that. To see the church reformed, to see it established in the truth, to see things brought into a state of obedience. For the fourth time or season would be any time of public thanksgiving for special deliverances. Look at 2 Kings 11, 17 to 20 and Psalm 76, 11 again.
2 Kings 11, 17 to 20, and Jehoiada made a covenant between the Lord and the king and the people that they should be the Lord's people between the king also and the people. And all the people of the land went into the house of Baal and break it down, his altars and his images break they in pieces thoroughly, to slew men, priests of Baal before the altars. The priests appointed officers over the house of the Lord. He chose the rulers of the hundreds, the captains and the guard, and all the people of the land, and they brought down the king from the house of the Lord, and came by the way of the gate of the guard to the king's house. And he sat on the throne of the king. And all the people of the land rejoiced, and the city was in quiet. They slew Nathaniah with the sword beside the king's house.
Psalm 76, verse 11. Bow and pay unto the Lord your God, let all that be round about him bring presents unto him that ought to be feared.
When there's been some special deliverance, divine deliverance, those are good times when there's going to be a public thanksgiving, recognition of the divine hand and all of that. Those are good times for churches and nations to enter into covenant with God. There's a consciousness in the forefront of that moral person in all of these cases, really, but in cases like this, there tends to be amongst people an even greater appreciation for the graciousness of the deity on behalf of the people. Right, fifth, when there is great lukewarmness and a tendency to backsliding. Deuteronomy 29, 10 to 15.
Deuteronomy 29, verses 10 to 15. Ye stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains of your tribes, your elders and your officers, all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the drawer of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into covenant with the Lord thy God, and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day, that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto me, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day.
When we have a great body of people, or there's a great lukewarmness, a tendency to backsliding, that's another good time for those who are more spiritual leaders in the church to move forward and engage in this covenanting. To bring people to a sense of that obligation. To ignite within them a desire to be obedient. To assume those duties. Right, sixth, in view of severe conflict with the enemies of the truth, to consolidate and strengthen the Lord's host. For example, Israel before crossing the Jordan. Look at Psalm 44:3 and Hebrews 11, 32-35.
Psalm 44:3. For they got not the land in possession by their own sword, neither did their own arm save them. But thy right hand and thine arm and the light of thy countenance, because thou hadst a favor unto them.
Hebrews 11, verses 32 through 35. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and of Barak, and of Samson and of Jephthah, of David also, and Samuel and of the prophets. He through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in fight, turned to flight the armies of aliens, women that received their dead raised to life again, and others were tortured, not accepting deliverance, that they might obtain a better resurrection.
Yeah, well, there's a conflict then with enemies of truth. Covenanting is a good way to get people together, get them on the same side. We're going to enter into this covenant. We're going to, in fact, turn aside the enemies of God. So that's really what our fathers did, and those fighting against the combined armies of the aliens. You have Revelation 19, 11.
Revelation 19, verse 11. And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war.
In times when there seems to be a need for consolidation, when the people of God need to band together, covenanting is a very good way to get men to consider something beside themselves, to move outside of themselves and move forward in a way that will advance the cause of God's truth. Right, seventh, during times of refreshing from the presence of the Lord, Isaiah 44, 3 to 5.
Isaiah 44, verses 3 through 5. For I will pour water upon him that is thirsty, and floods upon the dry ground. I will pour my spirit upon thy seed, and my blessing upon thine offspring. And they shall spring up as among the grass, as willows by the watercourses. And one shall say, I am the Lord's, and another shall call himself by the name of Jacob, and another shall subscribe with his hand unto the Lord, and surname himself by the name of Israel.
So when there's a renewed sense of the presence of the Lord, people are trying to retain that. Covenanting is a good way to enter into that, to seek to retain a sense of the presence of the Lord, to consolidate, in essence, that refreshing time. Eighth, when jealousies and contentions prevail, there's a tendency to schism. Covenanting will be a happy mode of binding up the testimony, which is in danger of being rent by schism. Look at Amos 3:3 and Hebrews 6:16.
Amos 3, verse 3. Can two walk together except it be agreed? Hebrews 6:16. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife.
An oath is an end of all strife. And so covenanting has been used as a means for putting down contentions, bringing about an increased harmony. Now, the thing about all of these things is that these are marks or events impressed upon history by providence itself. These are all providential calls, if you will, to covenanting. And that's because covenanting really is oath-taking. And oaths and vows are brought forth by providential circumstance. So when we talk about covenanting, when we talk about it as a duty, it is occasional and extraordinary as a duty. And it is because it is something which doesn't come to pass simply by a weekly recurrence like the Sabbath, or is brought forth by some predictable event. That's not going to provide the kind of impetus that we're talking about here when we talk about covenanting. We're talking about providential calls to covenant. Things that happen in providence that are out of the norm. They're out of the ordinary. They cause us to reflect upon that passage of time and make us, as we reflect upon that, begin to ask very serious questions about the relationship between the church and God, or between the nation and God. Covenanting is meant to address that, to bring men in as corporate moral persons in church, in state, into fellowship with God, into a more strict walk, a union and communion with God by His Spirit. The descending obligation of covenants is rooted in that natural representation. But covenanting itself isn't necessarily even something every generation has to do. It's something that arises due to providential calls. And that means only at some times in some places. However, once that's happened, once we've entered into that covenant, we should understand very clearly that the church, once recognizing those obligations and binding itself to an obedience with respect to those obligations, those obligations and responsibilities, those things are transmitted from generation to generation, and they don't go away unless and until one or both parties covenanting have gone away, or until the end of the covenant has been fulfilled. And the problem is, really much of what is involved in public social covenanting is not something that is going to simply be fulfilled and come to an end as a result of that. His moral duties are never fulfilled. When something's fulfilled, there's no obligation that's going to go along after that. But in the case of moral duties, the obligation remains from generation to generation. It's not shifting. It's not going anywhere. It remains the same. So covenant obligation shouldn't seem like such a bizarre thing if we understand some of those things. All right, we'll continue next time with the fourth term.